Welcome back to the Logic Consortium. Today on the show, we have Dr. Hernando de Soto. Dr. de Soto is a world-renowned economist and heads up the Institute for Liberty and Democracy, a nonprofit think tank in Lima, Peru. Dr. de Soto, in the year 2000, wrote a book called The Mystery of Capital that people have been talking about quite a bit in the last 8 or 9 years. It's described as why capitalism triumphs in the West and fails everywhere else. So today on the show, we're going to be talking about his book and some of the issues surrounding his book and talking about how some of his ideas are where they're placed on the political spectrum and possibly misplaced. So please stick around. It's going to make for an interesting interview. And we thank Dr. de Soto for joining us. Dr. de Soto, thanks so much for joining us today.
Delighted.
Dr. de Soto, as your work points out, there are many people that are missing the importance of a legal system for property rights that is essentially really an information system that allows people to get credit from mortgages because lenders can trust their information. And you mentioned how the single most important source of funds for a new business is the mortgage on the entrepreneur's house and the ability to use it for various purposes, mortgages, liens, covenants, easements. Can you talk about this a little bit more?
Well, yes, the general idea is that the word credit comes from credibility. It comes from Latin credere, which means I believe in you. And the reason I believe in you and give you something to move ahead, financing or a loan or the resources necessary, is because you've got something to lose. And to have something to lose, you need property. So the first thing that's very important to understand is that property not only has the function, or legal property has the role of saying who owns what and what rights you have over whatever it is that you own, and therefore draws a line between oneself and other people and clearly outlines interests, but it also has the function of permitting the existence of credit or the existence of capital, because capital is another way of using money to give somebody else a resource. It's an investment. All those investments require that whoever is being invested in or whoever's taking out a loan be identified and be accountable and be able to pay back. So property is highly related to the issuance of credit or the issuance of investment or capital. As a matter of fact, it would be impossible without that. But it also has a whole bunch of other functions, one of which, of course, is identification. The only thing on the face of the earth that doesn't move, unless you're Dutch, happens to be land. And so you can't actually give somebody an identification without saying what their location is, that is to say their address. And there's no possibility of starting to give out addresses or do anything systematic in terms of pointing out locations, unless, of course, you've got a property system in place. There's no way that anybody would set up a whole distribution of clean water or a sewage system or sell you electricity if they didn't know where they could collect for paying the bill. So as an American philosopher whose name I really, a man called Weiss, said some time ago, there are some things in life that just stick out and organize everything else. That happens to be the role of property.
You've mentioned how a legal system can be implemented that you envision over time to create this property information system, and how, for example, 120 years ago in the United States, things were so much different. And the difference is really a result of laws in the U.S. that allowed those outside of the system to come in.
Well, that's right. Before, even up to 200 years before, the predominant owners of everything were royalty. It was the blue blood. It was people who were part of the king's entourage of the royal system, of the feudal system, or the patrimonial system, or if you were closer to my part of the world, well, even in your part of the world, the tribal system. So at that time, property used to be, or shall we say, possession or sovereignty over assets used to be handled by just a few people with a certain amount of political authority. What's happened over the last 200 years is that all that feudal system, all those collective and tribal systems whereby politicians basically were able to own everything, whether they were hereditary or appointed, has given way to a system where any one of us can own something. So what has happened is that as we proceeded towards the democratization of possessions, we also unwittingly actually created a system that allowed us to identify each other and identify and single out assets, and therefore administrate them much better, and therefore facilitate transactions and specialization or the division of labor between people. So the coming around of property is a relatively new thing. In the West, it's about 200 years old, or to 100, and in other countries, like, say, for example, Japan, it's about 60 years old, because what you fought against during the Second World War was essentially a feudal system. And now the Japanese can own everything and own their land and take risks, and so can their former colonies, which were Formosa, today called Taiwan, and South Korea. And now you're having the same change occur in China, with the fact that, with a result, rather, that over the last 30, 40 years, China has gone from being a very poor country to becoming a good middle-income country. And that's what property does to you. It identifies, singles out things, makes you accountable for what you've got, gives you information, and therefore allows building the prosperity on which capitalist systems today usually, once in a while, thrive.
And am I right to say that you're not saying that a property rights system is a silver bullet, but rather a good system, an information system, can really help the people in the poorest countries?
Well, I agree that I'm not saying that this is a silver bullet, because you development needs a variety of other things, of course. You need good government. You need transparency. I think democracy or other types of information systems are important. I think civil codes are crucial. I think good courts are important. Education undoubtedly is a good idea. Law enforcement, all of that is important. So I wouldn't say it's a silver bullet, but I would say it's indispensable. I don't see how you could actually build a prosperity without a property system. And the proof of that is that there isn't one country that can be considered today prosperous that actually doesn't have a property system. It's only since we have property systems that we've been able to be more prosperous. As a matter of fact, in the last 60 years, where property has become much more widespread throughout the world, we have grown much more than we have in the previous 2,000 years since the time of Christ.
I want to wade into the political debate just for a minute. In my view, your argument is not a libertarian property rights argument. Rather, it's the argument you're making is that a property information system really helps to generate capital by creating trust. So it's more of an empirical argument without libertarian or neoliberal roots. See, the problem, as you know, and you've mentioned, is that in the United States, you mentioned property rights, and people say, oh, I know your agenda, you're conservative, you're libertarian, you only think capitalism. So how do we really try to get beyond this problem that I tried to mention?
Well, it's going to be very difficult for you Americans, because you're very stuck on how you have divided right between right and left. And, you know, of your democratic agendas and of your of what your forefathers left you, you've divvied it up. And some have taken liberty and made it theirs, and the other ones have taken democracy and made it theirs. So it's going to be hard to sort out. But in fact, it is not a libertarian agenda, because I can't imagine any government in the United States or Western Europe to go against property. That would be impossible. So it is a universal agenda. The next thing I think that is important to keep in there is that, at least in my arguments, I don't come around saying that property is the right of every human being and it is a God-given right. That may be so, but that's not my argument. My argument is that you can't make an economy function without property. You can't, I mean, the first thing that characterizes a market economy is the exchange of property. I mean, that's what buying and selling does. What you buy and sell is a piece of property. As a matter of fact, since you were mentioning capital, try and think of anything that you own that has capital in it or that has value in it, whether it be stock, whether it be equity, whether it be a patent, whether it be the manuscript for a new play or a Hollywood hit, or whether it be a music score, it's all on property paper. it is all on property paper. There isn't one thing you own that's of value at this moment and that surrounds you that isn't on property paper. So it's not a partisan agenda. It happens to be the way things are. As a matter of fact, look what's happened to your own economy now in the United States once you lost track of who owns derivatives. Today in the United States, you are entering a full-fledged recession. You have entered a full-fledged recession. You are entering deflation. The value of your assets is going down because the only asset that you have in the United States that is not recorded as property in the sense of being in one ledger, in the sense of being not spread out in idiosyncratic fashions, not easy to single out and define, are derivatives. The reason your banks have contracted credit today is because it is not clear which bank or which possible receiver of credit has got toxic assets. You've lost track of them. So look what happens to your own economy when you lose track of property. So it's not a partisan argument. It's simply something that is. And the sooner we realize it, the better, because it's not only about finger pointing within the United States. It means that every time the United States is involved, even outside, and you're a very powerful country, and you're involved outside your own borders in trying to decide a situation, some of your pro-property guys are in it, and some of your anti-property guys are in it, and there is no choice. You have to have property. So the sooner we get rid of that absurd distinction that property is a libertarian agenda, the easier also your foreign policy will be, and the better you will be able to fight your own recession.
As you mentioned, we're not talking about how you're going to distribute property. You're talking about how you're going to record it.
That's right. At the end, there are choices. You know, some of your people have decided to hold property individually. Some of your people have decided to hold property collectively. You've got cooperatives, you've got corporations, you've got trusts. In the United States, you can even get organized into a hippie community. You can decide, you know, whether you're going to manage things tribally through a corporation, like like people like the Inuit and Alaskans are doing it in Alaska. You have all those choices. Those are political and personal choices. That is part of the political debate. The thing is, at the end, you end up with a property system. So this has very little to do with how you distribute it. Different countries have different ideas about it. Some people impose huge inheritance taxes. Other people in the world decide that, you know, there's no way you're not going to be able, there's no way that you're not going to have your children have a vested interest in the property. Others ones will say that you're obliged to watch your wife. I mean, different people have different arrangements. But you all successful countries in the world, all prosperous countries in the world have property. How you distribute it, how you decide how much eminent domain you want in there, how much you think the courts or the government should have power over your assets so as to build a highway is another thing. The important thing is we shouldn't be talking about property anymore because it is the fundamental piece for development.
You're listening to the Logic Consortium in our interview with Dr. Hernando de Soto. Dr. De Soto is an economist from Lima, Peru, and we're talking about his book, The Mystery of Capital, and trying to put property rights and say property rights information systems aren't necessarily conservative. So please stick around. And to allow social justice-minded people to get behind it, you mentioned how a property information system allows those who care about equality to know just how unequal things are.
Well, yes, of course. I go back to your recession at this moment. The problem in your recession at this moment is that you forgot, for once in the United States, you forgot to attribute an asset, these are called financial instruments, derivatives, a clear record system that allows you to know where stuff is. One of the reasons, as I said, that your banking system isn't working at the moment is because nobody knows who's got the toxic waste. In other words, who's got the bad assets and therefore who may be insolvent. When you don't know that, that's why your government can't go in and help some people more than others because you actually don't know where things are. If you knew which our banks actually had the bad assets, you could make a stress test and then come to the conclusion that this bank is insolvent, this bank is all right, and then you can have a plan. But when you don't know what's happening, you can't do anything because you can't even, and among other things, you can't even redistribute because you don't know who's got what. The crucial thing, the great success of a capitalist system is essentially that if it works, everybody should know who has what. One of the conditions, as a matter of fact, of royalty and the feudal system 200 years ago, before you became independent from Britain, and before we became independent from Spain, and some Africans became independent from France, is that literally royalty could hold on to things without letting the rest of us know. So, of course, it had immense power, and we had nothing. So knowledge is a huge, important part of the property system.
As you've mentioned in your book, capitalism is really losing ground. And there's a crippling political debate, the left versus the right. And people look at capitalism as if it is a supportive of the elites only, a private club, a discriminatory system, which is really causing problems in selling what you're talking about, a property information system in a capitalist market, to those to sell it politically to those on the left. So how do we overcome this debate?
Well, what happens is this, is that most of the countries that, for example, require my services, what I do with my non-for-profit organization is I respond to heads of state who want to create inclusive market economies and want to build strong property systems in their countries. We're working all the way from the Middle East to Africa to Central Asia and throughout Latin America. And most of my clients are actually from the left. You see, the important thing is also that one insists, you know, that property is not an ideological instrument. You have to come in and indicate all the good things that property does. If you come in and talk about property as if it were part of a religious agenda, you're immediately going to produce antibodies. You're immediately going to produce reaction, because they've got their own religion, they've got their own set of ideals. But if you start saying, you know, how are you going to build capital for the poor? How are you going to give credit to the poor? How are you going to be able to identify the poor and single them out so that you're able to help them in whatever way? How are you going to give them clean water? How are you going to fight terrorism without bombing everybody, just singling them out if you don't know who lives where? I mean, one of the first characteristics about Osama bin Laden is that he lives in a cave without an address. When people don't have property and don't have addresses, you can't find them. So, you know, you can't even do humane repression of terrorism. So once you get the arguments on the table as functional arguments and not just, you know, just have the round word property in your mouth and you're able to explain what it is about, you should be able to make progress. Now, that's much easier said abroad, because we've got a lot of poor people and we're able to understand it, that maybe it can be done in the United States. I don't know that in the United States, how easy this is. I would say that in the United States, probably the left admits this issue of property, but I don't really, there's a different way of carrying this argument out, depending where you are. I've never thought about it too much in the United States. For example, in the Middle East, when we were there, invited there, one of the most interesting things for us was the first thing we did was start reading the Quran. And one of the first things Muhammad says in the Quran is that, you know, the first thing you should do is the things that you own, you should record them. So it was very easy for us to refer to the Quran, and that took care of the left and right argument very very quickly. How you do it in the United States, I don't know. But it does involve not talking about property as if it were a religious item, but rather about the functions that it accomplishes.
In your book, you talk about how a lot of people use the explanation that capitalism and the institution of capitalism is really a cultural thing. And then you go on to mention how this argument will one day peel away. Can you talk about this a little bit?
Sure, of course. But this has always been, you know, the argument. At the beginning, Max Weber, a great German sociologist and philosopher, you know, said that this had to do a lot with the Protestant spirit. But, you know, it didn't hold water very much, because some of the first capitalist states, like Venice in the world, happened to be Catholic, and probably the University of Salamanca in Spain was the first university to actually bring out a concrete theory on what emerging capitalism was all about. Then the next thing that you're finding out now is that from the United States to Western Europe, one of the things that that causes enormous respect and sometimes even fear is the rise of Chinese capitalism. So, you know, as time goes by, we start finding out that capitalism knows no borders. Unfortunately, this argument about, you know, ethnic or cultural superiority or having a special vocation got to there before, but there's really no reason that this can't work, everywhere. As a matter of fact, even if you look at Europe today, you know, some of the countries that that have been rising the most have been not Anglo-Saxon cultures. As a matter of fact, today the Brits are doing pretty bad at capitalism as compared to maybe the Portuguese or the Italians. So the fact is, the argument doesn't stand up. Also, you know, everybody starts saying, you know, you have to have, there's got to be part of this Protestant motivational spirit, and then all of a sudden you have the Indians rising and, you know, now making automobiles less than $2,000 a unit, putting out some of the cheapest computers and cheap computer programs in the world, and even as far as some Americans are concerned, taking jobs away from the United States. So as you can see, you know, it's in front of our eyes. Capitalism isn't something that's connected necessarily to culture. In other words, of course, capitalism is part of the culture. My argument is not that. My argument is that there's nothing that I've ever seen in any culture that conspires against capitalism. Everybody can do it. And you see that even in your own country, as all people migrate from different parts of the world to you, from Mexicans to Japanese to Chinese to Lebanese, everybody does it. You know, and even before us Christians were at it, 700 years ago, the people that were best at it happened to be Arabs and Muslims. So, you know, that argument for me holds no water.
You've talked a lot about how people who are left out of the system find another ideology and maybe look towards extremist movements, and that our choice is that we either must give people a stake in the game or that they're going to try to bring down the existing game. And you obviously have a lot of experience with this in Peru and the Shining Path organization, which was undermined by the government, making it easier for the poor to gain legal title. Can you talk about this a little bit?
Sure, of course. One of the interesting things about our experience in Peru is that when I got involved in this war against terrorism in our part of the world, a war that lasted 12 years from 1980 to 1992 against the Shining Path, as you mentioned, a very violent and cruel terrorist movement, inspired in originally Maoist China, I was wondering what made them have so much power, you know, and hide among the people. You know, among other things, it's because when you read Marxism-Leninism and you read Maoist theory, it's kind of complex. You know, it's kind of hard to figure out how very simple people, farmers and people living in slums, could have absorbed and understood an ideology so well, until we started finding out that what the Shining Path did that made them popular was essentially defend the assets or the possessions of the poor who couldn't do so in a legal fashion through a property system. And once we saw that, we then figured it out, well, of course, what we have to do is give the poor access to property. It isn't that constitutionally they didn't have it. It's just simply that the amount of red tape involved was incredible. I mean, if you were in a slum in Peru, it could take you anything between 15 to 21 years to get get a legal title to your home or get a legal title to your business. In Egypt, getting a sand dune under a property system could take you up to 17 years. In Manila, in the Philippines, it can take you 25 years. So we said you've got to then simply cut down that red tape and give the poor access to property. And the moment we did that, we effectively took away from the Shining Path the argument that it had for being around, because now government was coming in and the law was coming in and protecting everybody as assets, and you didn't need a bunch of terrorists with machine guns to enforce it. So indeed, when the reverse argument is that when you don't give the poor access to their rights and they find that they're continually being trampled on by those who do have access to courts and access to the police and access to political friends, people tend to and everybody starts explaining that the fact that they're getting the property is because they're culturally superior, people tend to form a separate culture that's an anti-capitalist culture. So indeed, it is a good idea to give everybody property so that we can take that away as being one of the motives for confrontations among human beings.
As you've noted before, the famous economists and philosophers Karl Marx and Adam Smith agreed that the division of labor, specialization, are what produced prosperity. But where they differed is that Marx thought that this prosperity would be concentrated among too few, and this would lead to conflict. And you mentioned how on this subject we really need to add what we learned since Marx has passed away. Specifically, you mentioned how he was not able to see how a legal property information system would become a crucial vehicle for the enhancement of exchange value. Can you tell us how you think this phenomenon might change the debate in Karl Marx's mind?
Well, yes. What's happened is that Marx, in effect, was a great admirer of the capitalist system, probably until today one of the philosophers that has best described it. What he said, however, that though the capitalist system was important in the evolution of mankind, is that it had an inherent, a deadly content, which was that there was a tendency for wealth to always be concentrated in each time fewer hands, and that property would eventually go to only just a few people. But what has been proved over the years is that somehow or other the West has continually managed to expand property. It's not that it always happens. It isn't that there aren't now a few very, very wealthy people that never existed before. But there's also a counter movement, the purpose of which is spreading out capitalism, spreading out property, and giving it to other people. And it's taken place without maybe many philosophers writing too much about it. It's just in the practice of every day, you're always continually finding ways of spreading property in the United States and Western Europe, not concentrating it. So in that sense, Marx's a prediction that the system would fall has turned out to be true. It's not that that hasn't happened in some countries, like, for example, in part of Latin America, there have been enormous concentrations, which have led to extreme left governments taking power. But generally speaking, we have found that there are in the West a whole bunch of devices and political agendas which continually try and review just how much wealth is concentrated and make sure that it's spread around, because it's become common sense that too much concentration of wealth or opportunity in just a few hands doesn't serve everybody. And that's why in the United States, since there's this sense of fairness that whoever gets the money, it happens to be people who had good strategies and were lucky or whatever, you don't really, you know, run after your billionaires. It's something that is acceptable. While in other countries like mine, where wealth is generally concentrated in a few hands, the issue of property becomes a contentious one, and we have more Marxists than you do.
Dr. DeSoto, thanks so much for this interview, and thanks so much for coming on the Logic Consortium.
Well, thank you so much, and thank you so much for reading me.
And that was our interview with Dr. Hernando de Soto, talking about all sorts of things, talking about how when people are alienated and don't have a stake in the game, they turn to extremism, and talking about how a property information system isn't necessarily a libertarian property rights argument. And thanks so much, everybody, for listening. You can find our – please go to our blog and comment on this show. Suggest another show. You could even be an interviewer if you want to read a book and talk to somebody. Logicconsortium.blogspot.com. You can also find us on iTunes at Logic Consortium, the podcast. And thanks so much for Matt Hudson and the Strategic Map for this great music. Have a great day.